This is something that comes up pretty often in couples therapy, is I think sometimes neurotypicals may over-assign meaning to things, and sometimes the spiral really is just like a lack of regulation or just needing to get it out, an info dump, and not so much that it truly is like, I'm in actual despair, this is crisis. My partner used to assign, if I forgot to do something, he really saw it as like, I didn't care. Like, he assigned the meaning, which I see a lot of, like, you don't care enough. And we really had to work on like, I truly care so much, right? And I've tried to obviously be better about remembering things, but also like, there's no malice here. That just went one ear and out the other. Nothing happened in between. There was no thought or emotion, really. So like, to remember not to assign that.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the Future ADHD podcast. My name's Grace Coolmer, and today I'm bringing you an excellent interview with Dr. Ali Arena. This interview is for you if you are in a relationship with someone who's neurotypical and you are seeking to help them understand how you work, or perhaps if you are neurotypical, supporting or loving someone with ADHD, whether it's your partner, a friend, a sibling, perhaps your child, someone else in your life. There are so many actionable tips and strategies and unique ways of thinking about relationship dynamics with brain-based differences. My guest today is Dr. Ali Arena, who is a communications expert specializing in the unique relationship dynamics between neurodivergent and neurotypical people, both adults and kids. She is a speech-language pathologist and a board-certified behavior analyst who is passionate about social cognition, language processing, executive functioning, and creating meaningful friendships and relationships. She's kind of like an interpersonal detective that searches for patterns to increase connection either in romantic relationships, friendships, or parent-child dynamics. Ali also has ADHD and was diagnosed late in life. In my conversation today with Ali, we dive into so many juicy and relatable relationship questions, and we talk about the differences in communication styles between men and women, the social strengths of ADHD in relationships, how to navigate chronic oversharing, info dumping, and vulnerability hangovers, all or nothing catastrophizing in arguments, having arguments because we're bored and it's a dopamine hit, becoming disembodied during conflicts and disconnecting from our intentions or spiraling out of control, setting boundaries, sensory regulation tips for supporting the ADHD kids in your life, helping your ADHD partner calm down when they're spiraling, and so much more. I can't wait to bring you this interview with Dr. Ali Arena right after this intro. Life with an ADHD brain can be a wild ride, swinging between intense obsessions and hyperfocus to exhaustion and overwhelm. And sometimes these pendulum swings can feel very lonely in a world that doesn't truly understand neurodiversity. But what if our daydreaming, impulsivity, and fierce obsessions all make complete sense? What if we're not flawed or disordered, but rather living in a fast-paced world that wasn't designed for our brilliant ADHD brains? Believe me, I know firsthand that living with ADHD isn't easy, and we'll definitely talk about those challenges here too. But after decades focusing on the deficiencies, it's time for a shift. Join me as we explore the latest ADHD research and take a deep dive into topics like unconscious limiting beliefs, habits and productivity, mindset, self-care, and nervous system nourishment. I'll also chat to a range of neurodivergent guests so we can challenge the status quo, change the conversation, and shape the future of ADHD together. Dr. Ali Arena, welcome to the podcast. It is such a pleasure to have you today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited about this.
Me too. This conversation is one I've been wanting to have for a really long time. And when I connected with you on Instagram and saw the kind of work that you do, I was really excited. So let's start off. Can you please share what it is that you do for work and why that is so helpful to the neurodivergent community?
Yes, for sure. So I have my own private practice, and a majority of the people that I see are late identified neurodivergent people, which means kind of like me, like I wasn't diagnosed with ADHD until I was 30. So I have like 30 years to unpack and figure out like how that's affecting me currently, right? So it's people who are getting identified as ADHD, autistic later in life, and really need to start to understand like, what does that mean? How does that affect relationships? And then the other part is I work a lot with neurodiverse couples. So that's either both people would identify as neurodiverse, or one does and one identifies as neurotypical, and you communicate differently. So it's helpful to have someone who knows that lens. Yeah.
Amazing. And so you're a speech and language pathologist and a board certified behavioral analyst. So those are big words. Let's just unpack it for everyone right up the top. Yeah.
And I'm also a educational psychologist. Literally, I just say to people, I really liked school, and I've always been really interested in relationships. So I feel like the speech component really looks at like communication and at like what, like literally how you communicate, right? And then the behavior part really looks at what behaviors are you engaging in that could be affecting you either positively or negatively, right? And then ways to like, are there ways to be regulating the behavior? Are there things that you're not even aware of? Most of us have pretty big blind spots, and there are behaviors that you're doing that are preventing you from seeing them.
Yeah. And I, when you say speech language pathologist, it makes me think of children. I think a lot of people think of children getting speech pathology, but yes. It's not very often talked about that adults need help with communication. And it's not too late, you know, obviously it's great to learn it in childhood. There's a lot of scope for learning there. But tell me what it is that you most often help adults with when they come in to see you, whether it's a couple or an individual. What sort of support are they looking for that you provide?
So I think one of the things with communication is we all have different communication styles, right? Like some people are more direct. Some people are more of a listener. Some people require a lot of information to get started. Some people can just get started. So like helping someone identify what style they have, what style their partners have or their parents have. So that's something I work on a lot. It's also a lot of, you know, if you've grown up neurodivergent, you've probably gotten a lot of signals like you're too much or you did that wrong or I didn't like that, right? So it's a lot of helping someone like get down to was what you were even doing like quote unquote bad, right? Like, is it hard? Are you overly masking and compensating? So that's a lot of stuff that I look at. And then from a purely like speech language pathology perspective, most of my neurodivergent clients also have some language processing. So that's the, you know, like I take information in and it doesn't always go somewhere immediately and I might forget it or I don't like sort it. So helping them build that a little bit quicker.
That's really fascinating. I have so many questions off the back of that. My brain is just going in a million directions. So ADHD. Let's make a note to swing back to that, what you just said about inputs and processing inputs and overstimulation. Yeah. And that would be really fascinating to hit back. But I'd love to know, just while we're talking about ADHD specifically, you have ADHD. So could you share a bit about your story, about how you worked out you possibly had ADHD, your diagnosis process, and what age in life it was, and how that was for you, that journey?
Yeah, so, you know, I was in therapy just, you know, as a person starts therapy in their, you know, like late 20s. And so I had the same therapist for a while. And I was like really stressed just about I was getting my doctorate. I like was in a bunch of weddings. I was annoyed at my now current husband. And she was like, I think that's just your ADHD really like flaring. And I remember looking at her and I was like, I don't have ADHD. And she was like, you don't? She was like, yes, you do. Like, did you not? I thought we both just knew you had that. So then she referred me. I love neurological and neuropsych testing. So I did the whole like gamut and found it so fascinating. And then, yes, it was very apparent I do have ADHD. And then from there, you know, this was probably like a year or so before pandemic. So I was just kind of like, okay, I have ADHD, whatever. Then pandemic rocked me because I lost all structure, all like strategies I kind of had in place. My husband and I were engaged and trying to plan a wedding. And so that was the first time I considered medication. And it's definitely helped me, but it also, that was like a starting point to them being like, okay, what therapies or strategies actually support this? And really learning about what it means to be a woman with ADHD, because it's very different than a man.
Yeah, and that leads into another question I have so perfectly, which is, do you see any kind of clear, obvious differences when men and women come in or other genders come in to your practice? And are there sort of distinct styles that show up for ADHD in terms of communication?
So I think women naturally mask better because we're sort of taught societally to like fit in a little bit more, right? Like you're supposed to kind of just, I think it's getting better, but like when I was growing up, you just kind of fit in. And I also think a lot of my ADHD women have, I mean, just significant shame, significant assumption that they're the problem, because I think for years, they're kind of like, well, why am I not doing what other people are doing? It must be me. Like, I must be different. Or it must be that I didn't get the right planner, or I'm just not organized enough, right? So I do notice a big distinction with just like significantly more shame to unpack and a lot less self-compassion, because I just don't think they understood why their brain was working a certain way. Like they were trying to be neurotypical and not realizing something was impacting them.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is you're saying that women and those assigned female at birth as well have been socialized in society to repress a lot of their natural instincts, to mask, to push it down. And then that creates this internal pressure system of, you know, incredibly critical of oneself, a lot of self-hatred or self-disgust that you can't seem to do what others are doing around you.
Yes, absolutely. Right. And it typically, and I mean, I'm sure you can relate to this. A lot of ADHD stuff is like relatively simple for people who can't see. I'm like using, you know, quotation marks, but the advice you get a lot is like, just use a Google Calendar or like just write stuff down. Like it's really hard for people to see like these somewhat simple things can actually be really challenging.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when I created my planner, I was so aware of that because I feel like people can just oversimplify and say, you just need a system. You just need this quick, easy fix. And actually, you know, it doesn't just apply to neurodiversity. I think all of us as humans are so complex and one size doesn't fit all. And so I was really aware, and this is why I'm trying to speak to so many therapists and other health professionals on my podcast, is that it's so multi-layered. And the reasons that people organize or don't organize themselves, the reason they experience dysfunction or communication breakdowns, is so often around self-perception, around how we feel about ourselves, our emotions, our emotional regulation. And it's not just about like, have this quick fix. And so, yeah, I mean, in my tool of support, I tried to include a lot of scientific basis and exploration around how your brain works neurologically, why these behavioral patterns are showing up, and how you can use all of that data and information to kind of self-assess and then bring that to a planning strategy or an organizational tool or a communication strategy. So, I mean, a bit ambitious, but, you know, a lot of people have found that more holistic approach helpful. And I'm seeing that approach really modeled in work like yours as well, Ali, where you're just looking at the whole person and not just the initial problem that they come into your practice with.
Yes. Yeah, that is a big tenet of something that I believe very, I mean, just so much that it's, yes, a person comes in typically because of a symptomology, but it's so much bigger. And if a person could just complete the task, they would. You know, I say that to parents a lot when they're like so annoyed. And I'm like, pretty sure if your kid could just do the worksheet and not have you be frustrated, like they would. They're not like intentionally, you know, trying to make their own life harder.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this morning before I jumped on this call with you, we had the school rush here, and my son is 7, a lot of ADHD traits, and he just struggles with those transitions to get out the door in the morning to school. And it doesn't matter what we do and how fun we make it or how many different systems we implement. Sometimes they'll work for a little bit, but I was saying to my husband this morning that we're going to have to keep innovating and being creative because he will get bored of anything that seems exciting, like a new, you know, visual system with reminders or some fun incentive or reward systems. All of it, we have to keep on trying new things and helping him find ways to help himself and get that, you know, build that self-efficacy so that when he is an adult, he has tools and strategies, because it isn't a simple problem to solve. I struggle with it, and I'm in my mid-30s now. I struggle to get ready in the morning. I get distracted. I prioritize things that I shouldn't, you know. Yeah, so it's just kind of knowing your own challenges and knowing how your brain can trick you and just doing your best to stay ahead of it, and then giving yourself self-compassion when you can't.
Absolutely.
Mm. Now, I can't believe I remembered this, but I really want to swing back. Amazing ADHD moment. I've, you know, wowed myself. But I really want to swing back to what you said before about inputs and processing. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So a lot of my neurodivergent individuals, I would say, and I struggle with this as well, might have auditory or language processing. So auditory processing is kind of where literally information comes in, but some people have like a heightened, so they're hearing everything, right? They might be hearing that I'm like moving my fingers right now. Like they're hearing it all. So it's hard to literally prioritize and figure out like what is important. And then where the language processing comes in is, so it comes in, but if you have a weak working memory or short-term memory, it kind of can just sit there and it just leaves. Kind of like when you say something to me and I literally forget it like a second later. I'm like, wait, what did you say? That's like a language processing moment. When your language processing is strong, you can store things in your long-term memory pretty easily, right? So like I see that you're wearing like a beautiful pink top. I might then think of other things that are pink and put it back there. And I might think of you now with a pink top. So it's trying to build that memory route for yourself so you can pull stuff quicker. That's really processing. And then to your point with the regulation, if we're regulated, like if our vestibular system is feeling good and we're feeling grounded and calm, information has a way better chance of getting in. Whereas we're super heightened. I talk about, like I use the visual of like an overflowing cup, because that's really what it can feel like. Like just nothing can come in. It's not going to go anywhere. It's sort of just sound around our ears that we're not taking into our brains, essentially.
So can you explain a little more about the vestibular system and how we can prime the body, some strategies that might prime the body, and tips and ideas for people so that they can have the best chance of processing information or being able to even set up supports for themselves to filter out information or, you know, import stimulation that they don't want?
Yes. So I am, I will kind of give you my knowledge, but I have a really good recommendation for an occupational therapist that I'll send your way, because I feel like she'd be a super great interview. But so again, your vestibular system is what keeps you grounded, regulated. When like a neurotypical person, when theirs is off, they might feel like vertigo or motion sickness. Like that's all that system. It's your balance regulating system. And so for the most part, and I'm kind of generalizing, I've found that a lot of my my clients really benefit from like strength work. So literally like, you know, either weights or like squats or anything that's like, again, pulling you down into the ground. Like think about grounding. I think most of us ADHDers are kind of like airy and light and can be like in our head, yes, right? Like literally flying. So you really want to think about pulling yourself down. Another way to regulate is, and it took me a long time to see this, I used to only work out because I wanted to be skinny, right? Like that was kind of my thought process. But once I actually started to see, whoa, if I go on a walk in the morning, I feel better. I can listen to my clients more easily. I can pay, like I really started to see that relationship with movement and calming my system and something calm, right? Like just a walk, listening to a podcast. I personally am not a good meditator. That obviously would be a really good way to calm your system. Mm-hmm. There's a biofeedback device called a Muse. There's a few of these, right? There's different versions, but that one I like because it forces me to calm down. Like it's like a little trigger where I'll like drop in and calm down. So I think anything that works for you, like if essential oils make you just pause for a second. But yeah, we're typically all like squirrels and energizer bunnies. So anything to kind of just like pull us down is really helpful.
I love those suggestions and I agree with almost all of them. I've tried, they're very, very effective. The ones that I haven't tried, I want to now. I think I have learned, this is probably one of my biggest lessons in the last few years, is that I do fly so high and I'm so disembodied a lot of the time up in this creative universe of thoughts or sometimes anxiety and stress, whatever that might be. And so the grounding is so important. I love walking outside with bare feet. I love going for a cold swim in the ocean. Love going for morning walks, like you said, because just looking out at the trees is so important. Just like I am in the world. I'm in a real world with beautiful things in it. And sometimes I can just get so kind of caught up in my own ideas and writing things in my phone and looking at Instagram accounts. And that has a place because, you know, part of what I do for work is connect with people and think about ideas, but it can be so tempting to just be there all the time.
Totally. Yes.
So, yeah. And I also love sensory cocooning, which is putting on the eye mask, the headphones, listening to something really grounding like binaural beats, or I love Tibetan singing bowls. And that just really helps me. The vibrations help me actually feel like I live in my body. Like this is my home, my body. I can sense things, feeling things. Meditation is tricky, but breath work has helped me so much with that as well. Just various breathing exercises, counting through, holding my breath, letting it out slowly. It's just, it gives me something to focus on that's not just airy fairy, just to take a deep breath, you know. So like, oh my gosh, there's so many strategies. So thank you for sharing those ones, Ali, because I think
I love
something
yours.
For everyone.
I loved yours. And I think you bring up a really good point. Like, I don't know many ADHDers that do well with just like, yeah, just sit and breathe. Like most of us need like a prompted meditation of some kind, right? Like
absolutely.
Focus on your hand or like something just to bring us down and into the whatever we're supposed to be doing to calm ourselves.
Yeah. And I feel like as well, when I combine certain types of breath, like, you know, rapid breathing and activating kind of breath of fire with like a really fast upbeat track, like one of my favorite high energy songs, that can really help because I'm connecting something really familiar that I love. Like maybe it's, you know, a Billie Eilish song or something, you know, something that I'm just like, yep, got it, know the song. And then I breathe to it and it's just like that perfect combination of familiar, unfamiliar, high energy and regulating grounding energy. So it doesn't all have to be like, you know, peaceful, you know, bells and butterflies floating through the air and waterfall noises. Like it can be like any energy that you want to bring to it as long as it, you know, focuses on grounding down in your body.
I love that. And I loved embodiment because I think that's really true. I think so many of us have just been like masking or attempting to regulate that we've like lost connection with that we're like actually in our bodies.
Absolutely. Okay, so before we dive in, I've got a whole heap of questions from my community, from the neurodivergent people in my life, from the neurotypical people in my life who are like, help me understand my beautiful ADHD. But before we dive into some of these questions that really focus on maybe the challenges, the areas for improvement, the areas of struggle, I want to start by grounding and sort of shaping all of this. And I want to talk about what do you see as the relational strengths of people with ADHD? Because there are so many, you know, challenges, but I really want to focus on some strengths as well up the top because we do have so many qualities that can be attributed to ADHD, and I'd love to talk about them a little bit.
Yeah, oh, that's such a good one. So I think, look, ADHDers we're actually really great multitaskers, which is a real benefit in a relationship, right? Like when you have to think about your spouse, your animal, work, like you are able to typically look at a lot more. I think ADHDers tend to be very like futuristic and holistic in their thinking, so they can get very big idea and see it. I also have found, you know, a lot of the women that I work with are so aware that they could tweak a strategy and it's going to make an impact in their relationship. And there isn't this defensiveness that it might see with like different, just other people, right? There really is this like openness to change. I think the constant seek too for like dopamine and newness in a relationship is really fun. Like, I'm now really into bowling, so my partner and I have been bowling. Like, I'm sure I'll be over it in 6 months. But I do think it brings novelty, whereas my partner, he's an engineer. He's pretty structured. Not too many new spontaneous things are happening. So I think that balance is like a beautiful thing in a relationship.
I love those examples. I totally agree with you. And I think the openness is something that doesn't get talked about enough, but we are so open to change and working on ourselves, and we're curious, I think. And when you're curious about the world and curious about yourself, so much can happen with that.
I completely agree. I love that. The curiosity is very true. Yeah.
Amazing. So now that we've started with that as our overriding context for all of this, let's dive into some of the things that ADHD is really find challenging and demystify some things, maybe translate some things into neurotypical language. So I've got a couple of scenarios I'd love to throw your way, and we'll sort of do a whole bunch of them and see how many we can get through. How does that sound?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so the first question is, I am a chronic oversharer, and I always get a huge vulnerability hangover every time I leave a catch up with friends or sometimes even a stranger I met on the train. Why do I keep oversharing even though I know I'm going to cringe later? How can I be more aware of what's appropriate and what others are comfortable with without spiraling and shaming myself when I get it wrong?
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. Okay. A few things. One, always remember, like, you don't have to match a person's vulnerability in a conversation, right? So, like, let's say I got on here and I was, like, really vulnerable about all of the challenges in my relationship. Grace, you don't have to also tell me all your challenges. Like, it's not a rule that you have to match the vulnerability. You might tell me one thing, but you don't have to spill everything just because I did, right? I think the other thing is, a lot of ADHDers are used to being a little self-deprecating, so we sometimes like use our own vulnerabilities to connect. And then also we tend to try to self-relate, and it's not a bad thing. That's like if, you know, I don't know, Grace, you told me a story about being at the beach, and then I told you a story about being at the beach because you talked about the beach and I wanted it to relate. So it's not that it's bad. But sometimes we can go a little far and like really try to self-relate at a vulnerable level. And another thing I found, I don't know if you agree, but I find that a lot of my fellow ADHDers are pretty empathic naturally. They have a lot of empathy built in there. So that could be happening too, to just check yourself, like, am I feeling something in them? So then I'm responding with more vulnerability. And then, you know, kind of what we had just talked about, like really trying to go into social interactions as regulated as possible. Like, I'm not really all that fun if I've had a really long week. Like, you don't really want to hang out with me on a Friday night. I might info dump and talk at you the whole time, or I might not talk at all. So kind of just being aware of yourself.
That is such good advice. And, oh, I mean, even just that last point about the end of the week, it's often when we're running on autopilot and we're not aware of these patterns that keep showing up. So It makes me think as well, I'm just thinking on the fly here, but if you do feel like oversharing is something that's coming up a lot for you and you've got that vulnerability hangover, I love what you said about info dumping as well, because it may not even be a personal story you're sharing. It may be just your, you know, special interest, facts that you love, something that's really fascinating to you, and you may not be aware that other people are nodding along politely, but actually they're bored out of their brains. So if you notice that happening and you're getting sort of feedback from that, or you're feeling off about it, I mean, I think ADHDers have fantastic intuition. And so we'll leave a conversation and sometimes our intuition will go, I think you may have overshared. And the other person didn't say that. And perhaps it's sort of linked to RSD. But that can be our intuition going, maybe we did, maybe they did feel uncomfortable and they didn't know how to say it, you know. And so if that happens for you, like obviously bringing self-compassion in there and going, oh, okay, well, I've done it again, but there are tools and strategies. I'm not an idiot. This happens to a lot of people, and there are lots of things about maybe more of that neurotypical spectrum that are really difficult socially too. You know, there are things that they may find really agonizing in conversations and go away afterwards and say, I really wish I'd said more. I really wish I'd tried to connect more with that person. I felt like I held a lot back and then I didn't get to connect. So they're very different, opposite ends of the spectrum with, you know, in terms of regret and I wish I could have done. But thinking about, like, I wonder if you could just create a journal of, like, I overshared that date. It was this date. It was about this. And then if you're starting to see just exactly what you said, Ali, about it's every Friday night after work because I'm so tired.
Right.
You might start to see these patterns of I was really, my nervous system was fried. I was exhausted and I wasn't as aware of, I know for me personally, this happens a lot when I have guests staying in my house because the extra people around, though I love seeing family. It does like sort of start to wear down my nervous system because it's a lot of overstimulation constantly. And so then I start to find by the end of the time that they've stayed with me, like maybe a few days in or at the end of the week, I start to become far less regulated and far less aware of how I'm showing up in conversations.
Oh, that's so true. Family visiting is such a tough one for me. I adore my family, but yeah, it's my system. Yeah, I just really have to regulate. And I think that's another thing too. Am I overly vulnerable with certain people? Like if you start to get that pattern, is it like they make me nervous? Is it because I think I did it last time? So now I'm like sort of like shaming myself and I'm doing it again. Like there's typically like a little bit of a pattern. So looking at that, I love that idea, Grace.
Yeah, exactly. And I will just say as well, with the example of the stranger on the train, the person that wrote this question, I added in that part about the stranger on the train because I wanted to kind of merge two questions together. But this has happened to me before. And my theory, I'd love to know what you think, Ali, but I think that in the past, I haven't done this recently because I'm not really on trains with strangers anymore. I work from home. But when I did, when I was at uni, this happened. I think I did it because I was bored. Like my theory is that sometimes I overshare with strangers because I am understimulated and I'm bored and maybe I'm stuck in an airport or I'm stuck on a train. And for whatever reason, I decide this is going to be my entertainment. Do you think that tracks?
I think that's really accurate, actually. Yeah, I do. Because I bet if you had a book you really wanted to read or if you were listening to a song you really liked, like this wouldn't be a thing. Yeah, I do. I think it's looking for stimulation. And sometimes I think, you know, we tend to be like more curious than others. So it could be a little bit of curiosity and seeing how someone responds. Also, I think we are all out loud processors. So to remember that like people don't actually have to be there for your process every time. You could even just talk out loud to yourself if you need to talk something out. It's not terrible. It's not a terrible idea at all.
Oh, yes, totally. I feel like sometimes I just send myself voice notes just into my phone, just to myself. You can do it in various apps where you can just send yourself a voice note. And that kind of solves that. And my husband doesn't get exhausted all the time by my need to externally process.
Totally.
And one final thing, because I love this question so much. I thought as well about a scenario when I was younger as well, maybe in my early 20s. And I was sitting on a plane. And I think for everyone, there is nothing more awkward than sitting next to a stranger for 12 hours on a plane. It is like among one of my most feared scenarios, like overstimulation.
Oh, I hate it. I know.
Yep. People pleasing. Anyway, I think I would just kind of be so much in fight or flight in my nervous system, I would just go into obviously dysregulation. And then I would just overshare because I felt rude not saying anything. So it was like either I was silent, but I felt rude because they maybe asked me a question about where I was from. And then it just ended up with my whole life story. So like, I think it's sometimes because you're bored and sometimes because you're like in fight or flight and you're a people pleaser and you don't want to seem rude.
I think that's really true. Yeah, I can picture myself doing that exact thing. Yes.
Yes. So I think my next strategy when I'm on a plane is to just go in with headphones, and my goal is to just not have to. Exactly what you said at the beginning, Ali, just because they ask me a personal question doesn't mean I have to ask them one back, or I have to. There are no social conventions. I can just literally be with my headphones on a plane, and it may seem rude, but it's like my time and my boundaries.
Absolutely.
Okay, I think we've got everything we could have got out of that question, but I loved every second. Next question. How do I manage my ADHD all or nothing instinct when having conflicts, when I feel like giving up on the relationship? How do I not scare people away by being too intense, but still remain authentic to my true nature?
Oh, that one is, yeah. So I feel that one, whoever wrote that in. But I think one, you're already owning that you have a tendency to go all or nothing, right? So I think this, like, regulation is going to come up so much. But really, like, you could do this outline processing, like, really trying to get clear on, like, because that all or nothing's coming from somewhere. Like, what are you fearing? What are you upset? And what got you to start being like, oh, it's over? Like, what is the real root of what's going on? Are you feeling like they might reject you? And I think, like, I know you have to be authentic, you know. So my ADHD-ness, for lack of a better word, used to, like, kind of drive my husband nuts. We've done a lot of work. But just my, like, I can be loud. I'm kind of, like, disorganized in thoughts. And I think we've really done a good job of making sure that, like, he can label, like, hey, I'm a little frustrated that I hear you, like, literally stomping upstairs and your voice is really loud, as opposed to, like, why are you doing that? Or why are you being loud? Because then you're assigning, like, as if I'm bad, as opposed to, like, a behavior, like, do you mind just adjusting that? Or he wears noise-canceling headphones a lot now, actually. But I'm just saying there's a ways to make, like, I'm probably never going to be soft on my feet, right? So a strategy is like noise canceling headphones, or for him to just gently be like, I have a Zoom call. Can you just chill for like an hour? And I respect that because I know he needs it, right? So being authentic, sort of like, okay, what are things that like I'm always going to do? And what are things that I can concede and maybe adjust on? And then all or nothing, it literally never works. That black and white thinking, it is always hurtful. Like it's not a positive frame. So again, really trying to get to like, what is the real hurt and what do I actually want to communicate? And what am I, I'm probably really scared they're going to say something. What is that I don't want to hear? Yeah.
Yes. Oh, that is so good. That's such good advice. And, yeah, it makes me think that sometimes we do like catastrophize. And my husband is much more of that logical thinking as well. And often he will just say, how did you get there? Like, it was like we were having a conversation about this and suddenly you're over here with this, like, you know, everything has gone wrong and nothing will ever be right again, this all or nothing catastrophizing. And it's so hard because in that moment when your nervous system's dysregulated, you know, it's hard to know how to help. It's hard to know how to help yourself, your partner to help you. Sometimes anything they say just like inflames the situation. What do you think about the idea of like almost like writing yourself reminders and you just like force yourself to go and read them? Maybe they're on the mirror. Maybe they're in a journal. Maybe they're like stuck on the fridge. Like, this is what I read when this is happening because I'm not in a reasonable state of mind right now. I'm dysregulated and I need something to ground me that I've written for myself to remind myself in this moment, my behavior is this way, but I am still loved by my partner. That hasn't changed, but the behavior is separate from how they feel about me. And so like that kind of idea, like, is there anything you could,
I love that. I've never thought to do like a phrase, but that's a really good idea. I think it's also like just sort of those continual, like all the time strategies. Like, are you doing any gratitude logging? Are you journaling? Like, again, kind of stuff to just get you out of your head. I'm also pretty vulnerable with my partner. If I'm like, I'm just kind of feeling like I'm annoying the crap out of you and I need some like reinforcement right now, you know, like, and he's finally started to understand like, okay, she does need that, right? And like, maybe because of years of someone mislabeling behaviors as like bad. I see if he says anything is a bigger deal than it is, right? So it's also like you working through yourself, like, okay, am I over assigning meaning to someone's comment type of thing, you know? I love the idea of a phrase though. I don't have it on right now, but I normally have like a fidget ring on that I tend to like spin, and that's kind of my like, I notice if I'm really spinning it, I'm probably upset. So it's like my own cue to be like, oh wait, you probably need to like take a second, take a breath. And also, I don't know if anyone can relate to this, but I've totally been in a fight with my husband and then halfway through been like, I don't even think I'm that upset anymore. Like, I don't even need to keep going with this. Like, I've just started owning like, okay, I think I just had a really large reaction. Can we just pretend yes. The last 2 minutes didn't happen and like reel it back? Yeah.
Oh, I love that as well. And if you have a partner that's fairly empathetic and understanding of the gears that we can switch into without really noticing that we've switched gears, they can kind of just like draw a line in the sand and say like, let's just ignore all of that, because they know that there's no real meaning behind it. It's just getting out stress, getting out energy, you know. It's almost like a hyperactivity sometimes, or a boredom, like I just need to create mm-hmm. some drama in my life because I'm bored. Like I've definitely been there as well, where I'm just like, why am I actually making this a big deal?
Yeah, like, it's okay.
So like the permission without any shame to just step out and be like, I was a bit of an idiot there. I was a bit, you know, like clearly that was just me looking for some stimulation, but we can ignore all of that.
Yeah, and really, I think that's so beautiful. And having your partner be like, okay. And, you know, I think I should say this because I'm just learning so much about this. We're, like, actively trying to get pregnant, so I'm just learning so much about, like, ADHD mm-hmm. and periods and stuff. And, like, our hormones are really, really crazy. Like, they're more crazy because of our neurology. So also to remember mm-hmm. that, like, are you having a reaction because you're about to have your period or you're ovulating? Like, tracking mm-hmm. that's been so helpful for me. I'm just, where am I am with my regulation and the ability to have, you know, like important conversations? Like I'm not going to have them the 2 days before my period because that will be a nightmare.
That's such a good point. And it reminds me again of that idea of like, if you see a pattern coming up mm-hmm. a lot, like oversharing or dysregulation and having arguments where you just feel like, why am I having this argument? This was pointless.
Right.
I wasn't really that mad. And if you're tracking that in some kind of planner or journal, I mean, I have a planner, but you know, any kind of system will work. That was a cheeky little plug. Any system would work. And if you're tracking that alongside your ovulation cycle and your period, all of that plays a big part, you know, in your emotional regulation and your ability to cope at different times in your cycle.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So, this is such a good question. It's a really big question. How do I know when my reactions are valid and not simply an effect of my ADHD, RSD / imposter syndrome? So that's really connected to the last question, but sometimes we might actually be really validly angry or mad about something. So how do we know the difference?
So there's a lot there. And I think there's like a few components. Like, remember how I started talking about how most of the people I work with are coming in with such a large shame cycle, and they're also coming in with a large amount of defensiveness and need to make a point because their points for so long were not taken seriously. Like, I remember just being little and I was basically in sensory overload, but my parents didn't have the word for it. I didn't have a word for it. And just feeling like, almost like they weren't intentionally gaslighting me at all, but making me feel like insane for having such a large reaction. But in reality, my body was in hyperdrive, right? So I think if you can start to realize that those examples probably are in your life and that you could be projecting them on people currently, but people aren't actually doing that to you, right? So I think getting really clear on what is happening in the present and what am I taking from the past? And that's a lot of like, that's working with a practitioner on some trauma work, right? That's really getting clearer on your own. Also like self-identity, what feels safe to you? Like that's really important. Again, like knowing your triggers, all of that will help. I've recently started really working in somatic therapy because of kind of what we were talking about at the beginning too. Like, I felt very disembodied, and I realized like my shoulders would be up before I even realized like I was upset or stressed or mad. So there was this like disconnect happening. So I think making sure that you're as connected as you can be with your emotions. And unfortunately, I do think having ADHD does lead to a decent amount of imposter syndrome. So it's really trying to pull apart again, like, what matters to me? Because we're typically going to have large reactions when a boundary gets violated. So, you know, if like I realized for me, a big one is time, and people respecting like my time and like when I can do things. So like, my husband used to try to have kind of like, you know, just typical conversations, really nothing too crazy, but he might want to like book a flight or something. But past 8 p.m., like, I'm just done. Like, all done. No gas in the tank. And so I'd kind of freak out. Like, I'd be like, but I've told you I can't. And so it took me a while to really pull apart, like, what's happening here is, one, like, I'm not keeping my own boundary. Two, like, we need to establish a different routine here. So there is, it's just learning yourself. And it's such a process. And I'm sorry if that wasn't an answer that's going to totally satisfy that. But it's, there's so much there. And what I will say is it's years of working with someone and just really getting to know you and what works for you. So you can identify like, no, I am really upset. This is totally about like a value or a boundary for me.
I think what you've said is absolutely perfect. And mentioning that people can work with health professionals, therapists, practitioners. For me personally, that's been transformative. I like to say on the podcast a lot that there's so many therapies that work, and so this is definitely not the only one. But for me, internal family systems therapy, which is a form of inner childhood work, you know it? Yeah.
I love it.
There's so many frameworks out there, so that's just one of them. But inner child work, you know, has really helped me identify my triggers and what is from the past. And I also want to mention as well, like what we said at the beginning about the positive traits of ADHD. Like, we are incredibly passionate. We have a really strong sense of social justice and a desire to bring about change, which is why so many of us are activists or working to help people in the community and create a better change for social good, I guess. And so when we kind of start to dim all of those more historical triggers, things from the playground when we were 10 or things our parents said to us when we were teenagers, those things are done. We don't need to keep re-dealing with them anymore and bringing them up. So when we can sort of sort through that with a therapist and heal those parts of our inner child through different therapies or reparenting ourselves, then the things that we truly care about, we have like mental space for, and we can kind of sort it all out and go, yeah, I really care about this issue. So I'm going to actually put my energy into fighting for that. And that is really important to me. And I will speak up about that because I'm now not creating drama around everything. I've got space to create energy around this one issue.
Oh, you said that. That's a beautiful way to think about it. Yeah, because if you're unaware of your triggers, you're kind of living in the past and trauma, everything's a big deal. We're like, we're already people who have too many thoughts and not enough energy for the thoughts. So if everything's also a big deal to you, it's really hard to put focus on what matters.
Love it. And the next question really ties into some of what we were just saying around boundaries and groups of people. So this question says, I'm learning that with my ADHD, groups of people are overstimulating and I need a lot of alone time. How can I practice self-love and prioritize myself without feeling selfish or guilty for taking less time with others?
Oh, yeah. We have a people pleaser, which I'm one too. You know, look, I think it's all about you're already noticing, like, I need that time to myself. And you know, to just remind yourself, like, I'm taking the time to myself. So when I see you next time, I'm in a better headspace and you're probably going to enjoy being with me even more, right? Like, and I'll enjoy the interaction more. Setting a boundary like that is, it can be challenging. Like, I mean, I think, you know, boundaries feels like such a large word, but it really is just like a few times saying to someone, Like, my friends know now. If they ask me to do something on Friday, I'm going to be like, nope, I'm watching a movie with my husband. Like, I'm dead. And they're not offended. But it probably took me a few times saying that for them to be like, oh, Allie really is just going to watch a movie. Like, that's what she's doing. Like, she'll change her plans if it's something really important. But it's nothing about us. It's she just needs to chill. And so just to remember that, like, it isn't actually anything about them. You have nothing against those people. It's just I need time for me and you deserve that.
Yes, absolutely. And it makes me think of some advice I gave out at Christmas that I actually came across. So I kind of shared that advice from someone else around the idea of like commitments and events and attending at different Christmas events when you have ADHD. And I loved this advice. It was basically for the whole month of December, make your entire default strategy a no. So I'm not going to go. And then then you can kind of assess from there which invitations you're going to say yes to. Instead of making your answer a default yes, which is a people-pleasing instinct, to be a default yes to everyone, to everything, to every invitation, to every phone call, to every email, to every conversation. And I thought that advice was so good, I almost wanted to take it out of just a December challenge and just make it my challenge is to make my boundaries just a default no. So I'm not having to negotiate constantly, is it going to be a yes or a no? It's a default no. And then occasionally it might be a yes, but I will decide that after it is a default no, if that makes sense.
I love that. I talk to a lot of people around how you can structure your life to meet that need to have some alone time. So like in our house, Sundays are like sacred. I really try not to make plans. I honestly might just watch Netflix. I might go to the dog park, but literally they're just like my day with my husband. But then also we try to, we're pretty good about this. We're getting better. But that the last weekend of a month, we don't do anything. So that is to be able to like, if there's house stuff or whatever, like that we actually have time to do that. And that's helped us a lot, right? Because he doesn't even have to come to me and be like, oh, can we do this? He'll see it's the last weekend of the month and that we've promised each other, like either that's time together or just to like, do stuff because you know how stuff piles up if you people please. You don't get stuff done and then you're upset that stuff isn't done in your house or with work. So it's kind of our time. It's our catch-all time and it's really been helpful.
Yeah. And it sounds like just taking the time to like create those structures so that they're just there ready to support you. You don't have to think them. It's the same pattern every month.
And it's default. It's so much easier to say, yeah, I just go to the dog park on Sundays. Let's try for next Saturday, right? I could totally bypass that guilty feeling. I have a strategy.
Love. And then also booking like the self-care time, the time on your own in the calendar. So it's actually part of your routine. So you're not having to go, oh, I was going to do that day, but I guess I could change it. It's like, nope, my self-care time, my Netflix, my reading my favorite book, my listening to my podcast or my morning walk, it's in the calendar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so changing gears a little bit, I'd love to talk about parenting for just a moment. I think it's a huge conversation, and I know you work a lot with parents and kids, so I'd love to sort of dive into it, probably in a separate conversation, but I did get one question from a parent that I thought was a really helpful one to sort of address here. So this mum says, my ADHD son has big emotions, angry, upset, confused. He often gets blamed for things he hasn't done. How do I help him navigate that without having a meltdown? How can I help my child regulate his emotions?
Yeah, you know, that's so hard. And I actually do see that a lot where kids are getting blamed for things because they can't articulate it that quickly. And so, look, I think that's hard to be able to get him to start being to communicate his emotions and regulate. I think what you could do is if you think like bigger picture, as a parent, I can help to co-regulate and infuse regulation into his body as much as I can. So maybe when we're getting it ready in the morning, we're doing like, we're stomping our feet. We're like, we might even do squats. We're doing things that just like, again, regulates the body, makes it feel calmer. As a parent, you know, co-regulation's real. Like if you are getting heightened while he's telling the story, he's going to get heightened, right? So really trying to be in a calming space and to check yourself that you're not really, you're sort of just letting, you want to sort of be the dumpster of their emotion and sort of just sit there and let them let it out, and you can sort of co-regulate in a calming way. Figure out what your child likes. Do they like deep pressure? Do they want a deep hug? Do they need to be under weighted blankets a lot? Do they need noise-canceling headphones more often because they're getting so stimulated by little outside sounds? Just really looking at what can I do to just help regulate them on a higher level. I'm a huge supporter of any, like, equine therapy where a kid gets to be on, like, a horse or is taking care of a horse. I have found with a lot of my neurodivergent kids that a pet is amazing. Like, it is a regulating thing. It is something they can feel proud of and have confidence about because they're supporting and helping a pet. That is another way to help a child really regulate. Give them ways, give them opportunities to become more confident and competent in something, right? So have them succeed in things like taking care of a pet or teaching a younger sibling something they're really good at. And I think additionally with that, most of my neurodivergent kids are awesome at something, right? Like, they know every Pokemon, or they're like insane at Rubik's cubes, whatever. Really lean into that. Like, how amazing is that, that you are good at this, and keep trying to get them to be challenged. Like you said, when we're bored, we tend to do things we maybe shouldn't. So making sure challenge is in there. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, all of that is such gold advice, Ali. I think people should definitely just rewind that part if they are a parent or they are a carer of kids, and listen back to it, because that was concise and just a heap of different strategies. And the only thing I would add from my experience as a parent, and I used to be a school teacher as well, is just that people do perceive meltdowns as negative. And in a certain setting, when there is no space, emotional space, like in a classroom setting, when a teacher has 20 to 30 children, they are very problematic because the teacher actually can't co-regulate with the child. And so that can almost put the child in this position of being teased, being bullied, being made fun of when they're in their most vulnerable state. And so kids are pretty intuitive. And if they have a kind of a warm and safe home environment, I've found that my son will hold in everything at school.
Yeah.
Like a little pressure cooker throughout the day so that he doesn't have a meltdown. He knows that his teacher doesn't have space and time for that. And he doesn't probably feel fully safe. He's on high alert. He's trying to do his best or follow the rules or not get into trouble or maybe not, you know, have that little altercation with that other peer next to him. And so when he gets in the car after school or soon after we get home, inevitably there's going to be some kind of meltdown, some kind of rage, some kind of thing being thrown. And I just want to speak to that and normalize that with parents that are dealing with this, that actually a lot of the time the kids are doing it because they feel safe too.
Oh, I think that's huge. Yeah. You know, and I think just kids and adults, right? So I didn't realize that I had some childhood stuff until I met my husband, who I actually think co-regulates me really well and I feel really safe with. And a lot more came out. So I think that's also just huge as an adult, as you're going through this and all these questions that we're having with relationships. Like, some of this stuff might be coming up because you do feel safe, and communicate that to your partner. Like, okay, I'm owning something's happening here. And I think it's because, like, I actually do love you so much and this feels good. And I'm going to now address it and get curious and try to see how I can support us through this.
Yeah, such a good point. I love that. Okay, we're at the very last question from our beautiful community. So this one comes from a neurotypical guy, and he asks, how can I help my ADHD girlfriend unwind when she is spiraling but still validate her feelings? Are there any ways to make it happen quicker so that she doesn't spend so long in a really distressed state and I can sort of help her quicker?
Oh, I love this person for asking this. So I think, again, it's going to depend on the person. For me personally, if I'm spiraling and my husband just like kind of, he's like, hey babe, can I just give you a hug? Like, he tries to break it subtly for me and just sort of hugs me. That really helps. It also sometimes does help, even though uncomfortable maybe for the neurotypical. I can only spiral for like 5 minutes. I'll lose breath. Just sort of let it, me getting it out is half of it, right? It's the dumping of like, let me just get it out really quick. But if the spiraling does become really long and like maybe gets really negative, I would try the strategy of breaking it with a hug or saying like, hey, babe, I can see you're really frustrated. Should we walk and talk? Because walking, again, anything to kind of just break it up and regulate would be good.
I love that. And I think empowering that more structured, linear thinker in that situation, often opposites attract. And so leaning into that kind of power to almost steer the ship while we're having our meltdown, while we're having our moment, instead of saying, we're going to go for a walk. Like, we're going to keep talking, but I'm going to direct us, or I'm going to get you a drink of water. Let's put up your feet. I'll give you a foot massage and you can keep talking. And just bringing in those little, as you said, like the hug, so important because it grounds somatically. And so empowering these partners, beautiful question to ask as well, very supportive, and saying like, you know, they don't have to be in charge of how this is going to go down. You can also have a say in how this spiral is going to play out, and maybe you are directing the ship and supporting them and sort of like navigating them through the storm.
And I think, you know, this is something that comes up pretty often in couples therapy, is I think sometimes neurotypicals may over-assign meaning to things, and sometimes a spiral really is just like a lack of regulation or just needing to get it out, an info dump, and not so much that it truly is like, I'm in actual despair, this is crisis, you know. Like my partner used to assign, if I forgot to do something, he really saw it as like, I didn't care. Like, he assigned the meaning, which I see a lot of, like, you don't care enough. And we really had to work on like, I truly care so much, right? And I've tried to obviously be better about remembering things, but also like, there's no malice here. That just went one ear and out the other. Nothing happened in between. There was no thought or emotion, really. So like, to remember not to assign that. And then, Grace, I am so sorry. I'm going to have to jump off in like 4 minutes. Just a heads up.
No problem. This has been such a fantastic chat, Ali. So just to finish up, the last question I like to ask everyone is, what do you think will happen, or where do you see the future of ADHD and the neurodivergent space heading in the next 10 to 15 years?
Oh, I love this conversation. Look, I really hope we're going to kind of get past like neurodivergent, neurotypical, and start just sort of realizing like people just have different brains, and that's always been a thing, right? So really just respecting like that people have different neurology and different communication styles. I do think, though, that therapies will continue to get more targeted around ADHD in particular, because I think for so long there was so much unknown, and then there was the whole like medication. There's, you know, it was a debacle for a long time, and there's a lot of feelings about it, right? Like, I still have parents who are like, I cannot put my child on medication. And that comes from years of a lot of bad press and a lot of bad results. And so I do think there will be more and more therapies that are directed towards ADHD, especially in gamification, because we're dopamine users. We like the positive reinforcement. We love that it can be like, there's a trajectory, there's a way to win. Like, so I really see, I think there's already some fintech companies that are looking at the ADHD brain and gamifying it in ways to like build your own savings and improve your credit score. So I really see that coming in more. And I just see more neurodivergent people really talking about their struggles more. Like, it blows my mind. This is in no textbook, but every neurodivergent woman I know has piles. Like, to me, if a woman has piles around her house, little piles of things, yes, or like, yes, papers out, like, they have ADHD. Yes. Like, I mean, I'm overgeneralizing a little bit, but you know what I mean? Like, that's not even a question that's on like a standard forum of any kind. Like, to me, that is like such a dead giveaway. If someone shows me their environment and I can like, yeah, see what they did all day and there's piles. So I don't know. I just think we're going to continue to like be more informed by the people who are actually in it and like can really give examples to how it shows up in their life.
Yes, I totally agree. That lived experience will continue to be so important.
Yeah.
So Ali, let people know, let listeners know where they can find out more about your work, where you are on social media, your website, and we'll put all of these links in the show description notes.
Awesome. So my Instagram handle is Connecting with Ali, A-L-I, and then my website is Connection Squared. I'm rebranding. It's like just about to go up, but connectionsquared.com. And yeah, I mean, I think I'm on Instagram often. It's a little bit of a hyper focus for me. It's not a good thing. I'm trying to break it, but you can definitely find me there. And yeah, I offer individual and couples support, but just also love meeting a fellow ADHDer.
Love that. Well, thank you so much for your time, Ali. This has been a fantastic conversation, and
thank you.
Have a beautiful rest of your evening.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for joining me for today's episode. And if you're keen for more, we have a lot of free resources on our website, futureadhd.com, where you can also buy our planners and support tools. Our Future ADHD planners are based on the latest neuroscience and have a unique build-as-you-go format, which makes them different to your average planner. This feature makes it ridiculously easy to pick up where you left off, even if you miss weeks or months at a time, without the shame spirals, guilt, or critical self-talk. Our digital version works with iPads, iPhones, Android tablets and Android phones, Windows and Macs. We also have a printable version for those who love paper and pen. Join almost 20,000 neurodivergents who have downloaded our planners and say that this is the first planner they've ever been able to stick with, because it's designed to work with your creative, inconsistent, divergent, non-linear brain. And if you want to watch a planner walkthrough or learn more about Future ADHD and our mission, check out our Instagram and TikTok, future.adhd, and of course our website, futureadhd.com.